Hello and welcome to How We Work. I'm Mike Lovett, and our guest this week is an engineer, founder and CEO of Change Enthusiasm Global, and author of the book Change Enthusiasm. Please welcome Cassandra Worthy.
Mike, what it do? What up, listeners?
Good. This is my last one of the, I'm time stamping this podcast.
Of course.
We're at Work Human Live. This is the last obligation that I have. So I'm ready to end it on positive note. Yeah. The pressure's off.
I'm going to do what I can.
Yeah. Well, this is a great start. We like to start by going past the resume, the accolades, the titles, and getting to know our guest as a person. So could you tell us a little bit about Cassandra, the person?
Oh my goodness. What a great starting question. Cassandra, the person is an incredibly curious person, an insatiable curiosity. And I use my power of curiosity, I both turn it in and outside of myself. Mm-hmm. Turning it inside of myself has helped me on my journey of sobriety, has helped me manifest all the things that I've manifested in my life, and truly helps me get to know me, and I think allows me to step into my authentic power every day. And it's because I stay curious about who I am, the emotions that I embody, the beliefs that I hold, and then curiosity outside of myself, feeling the energetic pull of my life. And for me, curiosity so often turns into passion, and I listen to it, and it's been a guiding light for me.
What's been the latest fascination or curiosity you followed?
So I'm really curious about virtual reality.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just got my Meta Oculus 3. Not just, I've had it for a couple months, but I love it.
What's your, how do you use it? Gaming?
It's all gaming.
Okay.
It's all gaming, yeah. So I love to golf. I golf with my dad. And so there's a golfing game on there that I enjoy. And then like dancing and fitness.
Okay.
So it's a great tool to use if you don't want to go to the gym, because it gets you active and gets my body moving, and I'm dancing all the while. And so Beat Saber is one that I love. And then I'm also gotten really deep into Supernatural, which is like a newer one that is marketed as a fitness app.
Okay.
But it's a lot of movement and you're basically dancing.
Okay. You don't have to share this if it's too embarrassing, but have you lost sense of spatial awareness as you've worn these and like crashed into something?
I'll share, Mike. And it is embarrassing. Yes, I did. Okay. And it was during a tennis game.
Oh.
And I hadn't quite figured out where in my house is safest to play this virtual reality.
Sure. You need a lot of real estate, I imagine.
You need a lot.
Just a comfortable amount.
And I thought like the entry to my home was going to be space enough. Uh-huh. But I was like rocking in a tennis match. I was playing in the U.S. Open.
Running up to the net.
Oh, man. I was moving. And I had a backhand and went whop right into a post in my house and hit my fist. And I was like, oh my. So there, it's like day two that I had this game. So my wife is like dying laughing. They like film me as I'm, you know, playing my games or whatever. When I first started, they get a kick out of it. But yeah, I did enter myself, which posed an opportunity for me to find a new location.
Okay.
And so since I've moved downstairs where there's a lot more room.
Yeah, padded walls, like just, yeah, you need...
Yes, my padded white wall room.
You almost like need to like baby-proof your house, but for this VR headset. Well, that's great. Giving our listeners a peek into the life. I love it. I want to dive into, a big focus of yours, which is change. It's something that freaks a lot of people out. Understandably, you know, what is new, what is unknown is... scary. But you've referred to that those feelings of fear and anxiety as signals and choosing to follow those signals. So obviously easier said than done, but what have you done that isn't super prescriptive, but what have you found in your work that has helped people embrace those feelings rather than run away from them?
So for me, what I find when I share my own journey, the frustration, the anger, the fear that I had when going through a really big acquisition, waking up not knowing if I was going to have a job, and sharing that and allowing myself to feel those emotions and to allow them to guide me into things that I care about, things that I value, and not to suppress them, not to ignore them. When I share that journey and how I was able to use this mental framework, Change Enthusiasm, that I teach, it's like it grants permission to another to allow their emotional energy to flow. That these emotions aren't these things that you're supposed to do away with. I don't advocate to have an aspiration of fearlessness. I think that fear is a big help. I think that fear is an energetic entity. It is an infinite resource that we can use. And through the power of choice, we can transform that energy. We can transform our emotional energy. And so for me, that's what's most, I guess, freeing for audiences, for those who practice change enthusiasm, is to have that permission granted. Change is difficult. And I do face frustration and anger and so much fear and so much anxiety. And that's a natural part of moving through change. It's a natural part of growth and evolution. But I have the power to use that emotion as guideposts, as signals to opportunity, explore that opportunity, and then choose how I show up. Yeah. How do I experience this? How am I going to use this fear that I'm feeling to inform me about what I care about, what I need to be watchful for, where I need to learn to move myself forward and become better?
Yeah. I had a former boss. She talked about being able to discern between a good fear of like, this is a fear I have because I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I need to do it versus, you know, genuine fears about the world or whatever. Yeah. But that instinct of just following your foot will kind of always take you in the direction that you want. And similar, you're not running away from that change. And I think it's really important to say, a lot of people think that, oh, I need to be without fear in order to do this. But knowing that it's part of it, I think might be a little bit comforting.
It's completely part of it. And I love the idea of being able to know what type of fear it is. Mm-hmm. And that knowing comes from practice.
Yeah.
That knowing comes from the practice of allowing the emotion and actually understanding, okay, where is this coming from? What are the thoughts bringing my awareness into it? You know, it's data, right? Yeah. And for me, I take an emotional inventory, and I invite practitioners to take emotional inventories to explore. Okay, I felt really fearful today. What was that about? What am I facing? What is there for me to learn? Or is this really a danger? Is this a connection that's not serving me anymore? Or is this an opportunity for me to more authentically connect? The more that you can practice this, the more that you can acknowledge and be aware of your emotional energy, the deeper you'll know yourself and the more in tune you'll get with that emotional energy as data, as resource.
Self-awareness has been a pretty common thread with a lot of the interviews that we've done today and over the course of this week. Of as AI is more embraced, there has been, I think, a recognition that, oh, wait, let's not put all of our eggs in this basket. We need to embrace the humanity of skills, of people, and that feeling of being self-aware is maybe the most powerful thing that you can do to start on that journey. And I want to talk about, you mentioned at the beginning, the acquisition. And there are a lot of huge organizational shifts, and it feels like they're becoming more and more frequent. And that's a very particular fear, especially when it comes to your job. It's financial security. You have families, you have spouses. It just adds and adds and adds. What about that unique circumstance should people kind of prepare for, I guess, is maybe the question. Like, Or for leaders, if they know this is going to happen, I don't know that like saying like months in advance, like, hey, we're going to have layoffs is going to do anything to quell anxiety. But what is the best way to deal with those huge shifts from an employee standpoint and from a leader standpoint?
Yeah, great. Because it's two sides of the coin. It's the person who's experiencing it, and it's the someone who was relaying the information and to communicate really, really tough news. So as someone who is experiencing it, the way that you can become more change ready and prepared, number one, is recognize every day in the work that you do, you are developing and fine-tuning transferable skills. To understand what are those skills that you're developing, that you want to develop, that you know I can use in a different job, in a different position, in a different industry. And be aware of that you're developing this knowledge and these transferable skills. And the other is to find opportunities to create low-risk situations that invite stress, frustration, anger, fear, anxiety. And a lot of that looks like learning. A lot of that looks like stepping outside your comfort zone to do a hobby or something that you're not naturally gifted at. Because when we can put ourselves in rooms where we're not the person who knows the most, where we're not the person who knows really much of anything, but can be the dumbest person in that room.
I know the
and
feeling.
Feel that. So do I, Mike. So all too well. But that's uncomfortable. Yeah. It's uncomfortable, right? But if you can step into a space, into a hobby and say, yo, I am here to be the dumbest person here. And I'm doing it intentionally because I want to be outside of my comfort zone. I want to be on that growth edge, right? And I want to flex and fine tune this muscle memory of being uncomfortable. And when we can practice that in low risk situations, no low risk environments, when the big thing hits, you'll remember it. Ooh, I have been in this zone of discomfort before. I learned something, I made a new connection, and I was actually better because of it. And I've been developing these transferable skills. And the other thing that I always invite people to believe in their heart of hearts, to say to themselves in an affirmation every single day, is that your value and your worth is not tied to any position or any job. Your value and your worth is intrinsic and innate within you. And all of the experiences that you're cultivating in the work that you do, again, you're just building your knowledge base and your transferable skills. And thank goodness for the work that you've done that gets you in a situation to then find something better.
Yeah.
Get something better. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to what you mentioned around the vulnerability. But before that, I want to talk about soft skills, because you've mentioned that as a key part of sustaining growth through change. In your work, how have you seen the change in perception? I'm talking specifically from the perspective of organizations and leaders valuing those soft skills. Mm-hmm. It felt like there was a time where, you know, oh, you're empathetic. Okay, great. But what are your hard skills, for lack of a better term? Mm-hmm. Have you noticed things come around a little bit? Has there been a greater appreciation for those? And what you said, transferable skills of finding things that are innate to you, finding a way to translate them for the organization. How has that evolved?
Yeah, it definitely has. And I'm so happy to see it. And I think that it was accelerated during the pandemic. And that's a part of the pandemic that I'm actually grateful for. And I'm in this place now. And originally, you know, when I started doing the work, I did refer to them as soft skills because that's the language that we had.
Sure.
But I think that it is truly evolving and they are critical skills. And these skills that we have historically called soft and that I even myself have called soft are not at all soft.
No.
They are some of the most difficult, challenging, tough things that you can do. And so what I've discovered in our work and in our research, that they are indeed critical. Thinking specifically about empathy, we discovered that at least for here in the States, and a lot of this was replicated because we've done our research at the intersection of change and emotion in a lot of different regions around the world, but we discovered that for 78% of working Americans, when they feel safe and comfortable sharing their truest emotions in the workplace, they more readily adapt to change. Mm. And so that's incumbent upon us as leaders, as peers, as mentors, to hold the space and allow those true emotions to exist and to flow, taking accountability to create the courageous container where individuals feel safe expressing those truest emotions. When I can get it out, when I can let it flow, when I can let you know what I'm fearful of, what I'm being challenged by, know that you're there to listen and to support me, I'm going to be a lot more engaged in this change endeavor, as opposed to, no, grit your teeth and bear it. Don't talk about your emotions. Leave them at the door. This is a business. We've got things we have to do. That way is broken. That is the way that I experienced a lot of change when I was working in corporate. And that's what I am striving to change with the research, with the work and everything that we're doing at Change Enthusiasm Global.
Yeah, that's, it's such a good point you made of like, that is, it's so much harder. You can wrap your mind around, can this person, do they have proficiency in this program? That's an easy thing to do. I would argue that's kind of soft. But it's much harder, like you're saying, if someone is expressing fear, it's much harder to handle that in an empathetic way. Often people, it will say something they don't want to say, or they'll be a little callous or insensitive. And it's so much harder to be vulnerable or be empathetic. And I want to just see the other side of the coin, because you had mentioned like how good it can be and how critical these are. For an organization that is just choosing to ignore that, what are the downsides if they don't value these critical skills? If they're just like, nope, that doesn't have a place in the workplace, grit your teeth and bear it, we're just here to do a job. What's the fallout of that?
Ultimately, I would say it's a competitive disadvantage. I think that at the rate and the pace that industries in the world is moving, they're going to fall behind, and they're going to find that their employees are going to be disengaged and eventually attrit out. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think that it's becoming table stakes for the pace in which the world is moving. And that's why I feel, and I'm so grateful that I recently got to meet Chrissy Smith. She used to lead Accenture's Global Talent Organization. And she said that empathy will be the number one most sought after leadership skill in the next decade. And I firmly believe that. And our research reinforces that. You're going to have to invite these emotions into the workplace. And whether you have the open invitation and the awareness and the acknowledgement of it or not, they're going to exist because we're emotional beings first.
Yeah.
First and foremost. And if you're not facing the entire human and this human being that's going through so much change, not only at work, but on all other aspects of life, then that human is going to start looking elsewhere, right? Because they're not getting what they need from you as an employer. And so I ultimately think that it will be a disadvantage, that they will fall behind and lose to the competition if they're not able to embrace the value of these historic soft skills, what I now call critical skills, empathy, appreciation, emotional self-awareness, emotional agility. Shout out to Dr. Susan David, who introduced us to that concept. It's going to be so critical. It's so critical. And, you know, you talked about AI earlier, and I listened to a lot of his interview, Sam Altman, at OpenAI, and he said one of the things that he is so focused on and truly concerned about, excuse me, is our ability to process the emotions that the pace of change is inviting. Mm. And that's what change enthusiasm does. The more you practice it, the more in tune you are with that emotional energy, you can immediately see, I am feeling frustrated in this moment. I know I'm being invited into a moment of opportunity. I'm going to explore this, and then it's up to me to choose how I move forward, that emotional processing.
Yeah.
And as the world moves quicker, humanity is going to have to move quicker to keep
right. up. And like you said, the resilience is such a big part of that, understanding that fear is going to be part of it too,
yeah.
and just handling that. And you've worked with a lot of different companies and a lot of different leaders, and I'm sure over time they and themselves have gotten better with practicing empathy. What have been the common denominators for those leaders that successfully bring empathy into the workplace? Have you noticed any patterns yeah. with how they behave?
Yeah, and I'll couple empathy and a bit of vulnerability. So
sure.
we're doing a big engagement with an organization, and I was having some join-up time getting to know the CEO. And the CEO is not known to be an emotional guy. Like, he's not one who shares his emotion and, you know, lives in the culture that a lot of us have grown up in. You know, mm-hmm. you don't talk about emotions at business or in, you know, in the workplace and business. And so, of course, you know, when I'm joining up with him, we were about to go into a big conference, and I asked him, so how are you planning to show a bit of vulnerability knowing that this big transformation is you're embarking upon it? And he kind of grinned, and he was like, oh, well, I guess I'm not, because I hadn't even thought about that. And so it was a wonderful coaching opportunity. But I talked about how, you know, it's so important that you as a leader are able to show a bit of vulnerability, to show what you might be fearful of or frustrated by, or at least think of a time when you felt that emotion, because you've got to meet your leaders where they are. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are going to be in that room who aren't where you are, right? They're feeling fearful. They have anxiety, not knowing what this new world is going to be like. And so I was so proud of him. He and I had a chat on the stage after I had keynoted for them, and he expressed what that conversation meant to him, and he actually shared vulnerability from the stage and the impact that they had that had to his top leadership. It was tremendous. And it was like he was granting permission for others to share their emotional energy as well. And so it invited connection and invited engagement. And so at first, there are certainly individuals that are going to be resistant because it's not the way that they grew up. It's not the way that they got in the position that they're in, right? It's new. It's different. It seems touchy-feely. Maybe some might say woo-woo.
Mm-hmm.
But when they can step into it in a very authentic way, it is so powerful and engaging and influencing thousands of people, thousand strong workforce.
That giving permission idea is such a good one. And that's perfectly lead into my next question, which is around vulnerability, not only just its role in the workplace generally, which I want you to hit on, but I want specifically men experiencing or expressing vulnerability at work and the permission that grants, because a lot of people in charge
Yeah.
our guys.
Yeah, of course.
And I not to like paint too broad a brush, but I think there is, I'll say, a decent amount of men in charge who are maybe looking at these as a little too touchy-feely, are from a time where this did not have a place in the workplace. And to your point, you want to meet them where they are, But I guess for any men listening who are maybe feeling that way, talk a little bit more about the power, the permission that grants, and the downstream effect of when you express vulnerability, what that does for everybody else.
Of course. So Maya Angelou, I think, encapsulated this best. People won't remember what you tell them, but they'll remember the way you make them feel. Mm. Vulnerability creates a conduit for emotional energy to flow. And in that is authentic connection. When you can share your emotions, something that's challenged, that you're being challenged by, you are unleashing your authentic power and you're allowing the conduit for emotional energy to flow. It creates connection. And so that's my selling point for the men who are in charge. The other thing that I think is important to talk about in vulnerability is that vulnerability is a privilege. It's a privilege. There are individuals who look like me, and I sit at a lot of different intersections. I'm queer, I'm black, I'm female, founder, CEO. There are people who look like me in the workforce who don't feel that they have the privilege to be vulnerable, to share anger, to share frustration because of what it would do to their career and the possibility that they have for advancement. And so they can't share vulnerability. Mm-hmm. They have to always be buttoned up because they feel they don't have that privilege. When men can not only step into a role of sharing their own vulnerability to create that authentic connection, but also hold themselves accountable to creating that courageous container to know that that privilege is being granted to everyone in the organization, including those in marginalized populations, that again will boost levels of engagement. But I think it's prudent upon everyone to recognize that vulnerability is a privilege. And there's a lot of people just by the way that they show up in the world and the way that they show up in the workplace that they feel like that privilege has not been granted to them. And so it's important that we're mindful of that.
Kiana Schmiedel, our CHRO, has talked before. Psychological safety is a big focus of ours. And she's made the point before, yes, that's great, but some people need to express psychological bravery to be able to, exactly what you're saying, just in a different way, allow others to know that this is a safe space. So if they are in a marginalized community, if they do have, you know, they're already feeling like they're at the razor's edge, and any misstep is the difference between a promotion or, you know, being overlooked. That is such a huge thing to, it's a hidden thing. You're not going to see it. You're not going to hear it unless you yourself kind of take it. And I think framing it as a privilege, and again, getting back to that self-awareness, like understanding you're in a position of power, using that for good to open it up for everybody. Yeah. I love
and
it.
Role model it and celebrate it. When you see it in an individual, especially someone in a marginalized population, thank them for the vulnerability.
Not a to-do list type thing.
That.
Yeah.
Right? Because as soon as you start giving them data, if I show up vulnerable, then I'm going to be chastised. They're not going to listen to me. Then they're going to shut down and you won't see that vulnerability again. When you see it, celebrate it. Thank them. That is something, that behavior that we want to see elevated in our leadership. Thank you for stepping into your vulnerability. You can go so far.
Yeah, it's like a key component to the idea of recognition, which is what we do anyway. It's like you want to reinforce the good things that you see. If you just think it to yourself, it's like, okay, great, you saw that, but that is not doing anything for the other person that did that. And they're continually guessing as to, did I do the right thing or not? Was this valued or not? Yeah. I love that. My last question. You talked a little bit about this before, innate strengths to people. What are some practical steps that people can take to maybe suss out innate strengths that they have that aren't super obvious or, you know, I think to them might not be thought of as valuable to an organization, but, you know, then you get into work and you realize, oh yeah, patience would be really important here. Empathy would be really important. But I think traditionally those kinds of things haven't been suggested to be put on a resume, but maybe should, or in a cover letter, whatever. So for anyone, leader, employee, whatever it may be, what are some exercises? What are some things they can do to help see the value of their own innate strengths and translate them?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And so often we're blind to them, right? The way that we show up in the world and the impact that we're having on others. It's such a good question because it's an exercise that I did for myself that is the reason that I'm doing the work that I do today. One of the many reasons. And it was one day because I had this curiosity, this intuition whispering, telling me, Cassandra, there's something different that you're supposed to be doing to share your gifts with the world that's not leading innovation in a big corporation. And I didn't know what that was. I just heard the whisper. And so one day I sat down and I journal all the time. It's a spiritual practice for me. And I started thinking about all the compliments that I had heard from people, things that people say to me that I hear often. And I just started writing them down. And then I actually started just like, just kind of not necessarily interviewing people, but asking, what do you think I'm really, really good at? Like, what do you value most in what I bring to the table? What do you think I can do that hardly no one else can do? Like,
yeah.
Why are you seeking me out? And it's trying to get at that secret sauce, right? And so when I started pulling all that together, and for me, it was always about my energy. Cassandra, your energy, my goodness, the way you light up a room, the way that you can connect us, the way that you engage people. And I started writing all that down, and it started to look like, okay, well, speaking or somehow in, you know, influencing, leading, which I was doing in the workplace, but it kind of led me towards, could it be a career in speaking? Could it be, you know, I also, you know, my written work is I got commended as well. So could I be an author? And so that's kind of put me on the path of getting curious about, can I command a platform? You know, should I write a book? But it was really understanding what is the thing that I hear from other people that they say I can do like nobody else. The way that I show up, the way that they engage with me and can see in me that they don't see in so many other people. That's your secret sauce. That's something that really truly sets you apart. And you got to ask, right?
Yeah.
And listen for it. That thing that you hear so often from so many people, there's something there. And that's a part of your gift. And, you know, it's about finding that and sharing it.
A few years ago, I spoke to Emily Heafy, who's a professor at University of Massachusetts, and she talked about a very similar exercise where imagine a bunch of people in a room. Mm-hmm. Everyone is taking turns and, okay, it's Cassandra's turn. Everyone writes something that they admire about Cassandra. And very similar to what you're saying. And she said something that has stuck with me ever since. Those exercises can provide positive redirections of, you're going to probably tell this person something they did not realize about themselves. And her personal example was someone had highlighted her leadership skills, something she never thought about. And 2 weeks later, you know, a leadership position on a focus group or something of the like opened up. She applied for it. She got it. And she, I can't imagine my life without that now. And that never would have happened without that positive redirection. So I love that as it's a very easy exercise. It does feel like, at least culturally, there is a push toward giving people their flowers before it is too late, or not waiting for these, you know, marquee moments. We, you know, it tends to be weddings or, you know, maybe a big birthday or tragically funerals where you hear those honest feelings about people, but it is so much more valuable to not wait for those moments when you think of them or just carving out time wherever you can.
I'm telling you. And the majesty comes. There's a word in Japan, in the Japanese language. They don't have one for retirement. They have a word called ikigai. And it's about combining the thing that you're naturally talented at, gifted at, the thing that you just love doing, that you would get up in the morning and do for free, the thing that the world needs, so a problem that you're solving, and then making money. When you can combine all four of those, and it's a Venn diagram, it's beautiful, it's an engineer, I just love it. But at the center of this Venn diagram is your ikigai. And I have discovered that in the work that I do now, and it is the most incredible feeling to be operating within my ikigai. And, you know, so we all know this quote, when you do the thing that you love, you never work a day in your life. I think that's incomplete. Honestly, mm-hmm. I think we need to stop saying that, or at least if we do, round it out. You will work more than you have ever worked in your life, but it will be fulfilling. And after a 16-hour day and you're exhausted and you're crawling into bed and your bones hurt, you'll be excited to wake up the next day and do it all over again because it's what you're supposed to be doing.
Purpose is a powerful drug.
It is huge. I'm keep coming back.
This has been an extraordinary conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.